Welcome to the GRF On The Go podcast. The subject matter experts at GRF CPAs and Advisors created this podcast to offer insights on current topics, as well as new ideas and best practices that your team can apply today. This podcast was originally presented as a live webinar. CPE information provided during the podcast is no longer valid, but if you're interested in watching the video version of this session or accessing the slide deck, visit our website at grfcpa.com/events. Enjoy the episode and remember to subscribe for future content.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our webinar today. We're going to be presenting on some key tax planning considerations for 24 and 25 tax years. So getting you ready for your filings for this calendar year, as well as some items for 2025. We want to highlight that some changes might be coming into effect for 2026. So there's going to be some planning opportunities for 2025 if there are no current law changes. My name is Ryan Hamm, and I'm the partner and the director of our for-profit tax department here at GRF. Today, we're joined here by some of my senior colleagues, Julie Hulam and Mark Sackets. Julie is a partner and Mark is a senior manager within our department. The three of us have a wealth of experience and knowledge in dealing with taxes, so we have a lot of great stuff to share with you today. Please note that this webinar is not intended for financial or legal advice. This is simply for educational purposes and some ideas to speak with your advisors. So a little about our firm. We are GRF CPA and Advisors. We're based out of Bethesda, Maryland, serving clients in the DMV as well as nationally and internationally. Our firm serves a wide range of clients covering not-for-profit, for-profit, schools, government contractors, and other clients. However, our particular niche is within not-for-profit, INGO space. However, the three of us that you're speaking to are in our for-profit tax division today. We've been operating for several decades, and in 2021, we celebrated our 40th anniversary. As you can see here today, we have some exciting content to cover. So without further ado, let's get into it and start with Mark in individual tax discussion.
Thanks, Ryan. Good morning, everyone. As Ryan mentioned, we've got kind of a wide range of discussion topics today. The first on the agenda is the individual tax discussion. So we'll go ahead and kick off the topics now for this. So first, before we kind of get into the content and the materials and the slides, there's 2024, 2025, and into 2026 is a very important year, for taxes, not just on the individual side of things, but businesses, estates, trusts, etc. So the goal for us today is to kind of give you a highlight and a snapshot of where we are for 2024, where we are for 2025 tax planning. But for, the individual tax planning in particular, the changes that were enacted as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, the individual tax provisions related to that act were temporary in nature. So those are scheduled to lapse, barring any, legislation that gets passed starting January 1, 2026. So the point, I think, for the discussion today is to kind of highlight where we are for 2024, and then have a brief discussion in terms of what we're looking for 2025 and into 2026. The results of the election and the makeup of the new Congress that's kind of being transitioned into right now gives us a much clearer picture about what we think is going to happen. So we have, certain topics that we can look to and, highlight where we think there can be kind of extensions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provisions, or where we think, things could lapse. So having said that, I think what we've got here on screen is just the 2024 income tax rates for our individuals. As you can see, the rates go from 10% up to the top rate, marginal rate of 37%. And we've broken it out by filing status for the different, taxable income for the different filing statuses as well. On the next screen, we've got the 2024 capital gains and qualified dividends tax rates. You'll see that we continue to have the three different brackets, 0, 15, and 20%. There's a couple of things that I want to highlight and call out on this screen in particular. Number one is, you know, we've noted 20% is the top rate for capital gains and qualified dividends. However, I do want to highlight the net investment income tax of 3.8% as well. Depending on where you are in terms of your AGI and your taxable income, the net investment income tax could apply. So while we put 20% in this rate, just be mindful that the 3.8% net investment income tax could also apply, pushing the top capital gains rates up to 23.8% potentially. Another topic that I want to make sure that we highlight here related to capital gains in particular. So we know the traditional kind of capital gains assets that we think about, stocks, bonds, real estate, things along those lines, you know, tangible property that everyone's kind of aware of. But I also want to highlight too is cryptocurrency. So this is an area that's kind of exploded in the last couple of years at least, and not just kind of one-off people doing it through the side, you know, on the sides. This is something that retail investors, I think, are very heavily kind of invested in as well. There are additional disclosures, documentation points that need to be considered related to cryptocurrencies. So if you're working with clients, make sure you're asking about cryptocurrencies. If you are working with another CPA, make sure that you're providing information related to crypto. Is that scenario, like I said, that we've just seen pretty substantial growth over the last couple of years as well. Okay, as I mentioned, you know, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was passed, the individual provisions were not permanent, you know, changes. So the lowered marginal tax rates, the expanded brackets were not permanent. And as part of the legislation, you know, those reduced rates and expanded brackets are scheduled to revert back to the pre-TCJA levels starting January 1, 2026. Now, as I mentioned previously, with the kind of Republican control of Congress, it is widely expected that we will get some sort of a expansion or continuation of the individual provisions that we've got now. However, as of right now, you know, nothing has been passed, so this is something that we're continuing to monitor. You know, marginal rates, the brackets are scheduled to revert back. And we'll see kind of what the negotiations look like as we continue here into 2025. However, until, you know, negotiations are have been completed, we really don't know what those brackets and what those are going to look like. I think the best guess at this point is probably an extension of what we've got in terms of the individual rates and the brackets, et cetera. However, you know, there are discussions about potentially even further reducing the top marginal rates, further expanding the brackets such that, you know, income is taxed at a lower rate altogether. So please be mindful of these while you're going through 2025 and thinking about 2026. So, you know, if we get a further reduction of marginal tax rates into 2026, then start to think about ways that you can either defer income into 2026, accelerate expenses into 2025, then just take advantage of, you know, possibility of different changes in the tax rates as well. Okay, so some different things that we wanted to mention here. Obviously, standard deduction versus the itemized deductions. So for 2024, the standard deduction has further been increased, $29,200 for married filing joint, $21,900 for head of household, and then $14,600 for singles and married filing separately. Obviously, you need to review your itemized deductions for the year and determine best course of action to make sure you understand which one is right for your scenario. We wanted to highlight specific itemized deductions. Medical expenses, obviously still there at the AGI threshold for 2024. State and local tax deduction, still capped at $10,000 for 2024 and 2025. This is an area that we're monitoring very heavily in 2025 related to potential tax legislation and extension of the TCJA provisions. The Republican control of the House of Representatives is pretty thin. And so it's going to take pretty much everyone to pass this budget through the reconciliation process. There have been some Republican members of Congress in high tax states, such as California and New York, who have said that they want, you know, the SALT cap, the SALT deduction cap to be looked at in terms of, you know, any extensions for the TCJA provisions. We obviously don't know, but this is an area that I think that has been pretty contentious in terms of the impacts to a lot of individuals. And so again, for 2024 and 2025, still capped at $10,000. But this is an area that we're watching very heavily to see if there's an expansion of this cap, if they get rid of the cap altogether. And unfortunately, we just still don't know at this point what that's going to look like. But again, for 2025 and going into 2026 tax planning, please be aware that, you know, this is an area that's being discussed quite heavily and has potential ramifications too for, you know, what we look at for 2026 estimates and, you know, the impact to you and your clients as well. Highlighting mortgage interest as well. You know, pre-TCJA, you could deduct mortgage interest up to $1 million on of indebtedness. After December 15th, 2017, the cap is at $750,000. So be mindful when you're doing your tax computations to make sure that you're asking the question about when the mortgage was initiated. We've seen some people who've done refinance or you know, sales, obviously, in the last handful of years too. So make sure that you're understanding when the mortgage was originated and limiting any mortgage interest deduction where required. Charity or itemized deductions. So please be mindful of the limitations for different types of charity deductions or contributions. So cash and non-cash have a different kind of AGI threshold. Whether you're, you know, for the type of property that you're donating. We are also kind of highlighting the capital gain property. So this is a nice area that you can look at in terms of tax planning. So if you have an appreciated capital gain asset that you are looking for some sort of charitable donation and deduction for that, you can donate the property and get a charitable donation deduction for the fair market value of it, and you don't have to pay the tax on the appreciation. So we have an example here. You know, if you have $200,000 of stock with a basis of $100,000, you can donate the $200,000 of stock and not have to, you know, recognize the gain on that $100,000. So it's a nice area of potential tax savings for sure. Other items related to charitable donations, donor advised funds. This is something that we've seen quite a bit, I think, in terms of donations too. So you can set up a donor advised fund a lot of times through retail brokerages. So you can make a large gift to the fund in year one and take the full deduction, but then you can spread the giving out over, you know, a handful of years. Same thing, you can donate cash and stock. But the donor advised fund is something that we've seen quite a bit over the last handful of years and can be a really good way to maximize your charitable givings. Qualified charitable distributions. So you can make a direct transfer from an IRA to a charitable organization. And, you know, there's certain requirements in order for this to be met, but the taxpayer has to be at least 70 and a half at the time of transfer. And the maximum amount that you can do is $100,000 per year per taxpayer. So the distribution is not taxable, but the contribution is not deductible. But a lot of times you can do this to satisfy your RMDs from your IRAs. So if you have that and you're looking for a way to kind of, you know, satisfy your RMDs while also making a donation to a charitable organization, this is a good kind of, you know, tax planning tool that you can look at as well. Okay, individual tax. So what we're watching in terms of, you know, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provisions cliff, as I said, absent any updated legislation for throughout the rest of the year, you know, the standard deduction is scheduled to revert to the pre-TCJA deduction levels as of January 1, 2026. Personal exemptions are scheduled to return as of January 1, 2026. I don't know how many of us forgot about those, but that's still a thing. Itemized deductions, like I said, the SALT cap is definitely something that we're looking at. And right now it's scheduled to be phased out. But again, I think it's maybe something that is potentially part of negotiations going forward here. Miscellaneous deductions subject to 2% of AGI would schedule to be returned January 1. And then the mortgage indebtedness is scheduled to revert to $1 million as well. As I said before, with the Republican control of Congress, we do not expect that many of these things will kind of lapse. I think that a lot of the TCJA provisions will likely get extended. But again, these are things that we're looking at and that we're monitoring. And barring any kind of, like I said, legislation throughout 2025, these are the items that potentially could return as part of the TCJA kind of cliff, if you will. The child tax credit, this is one that I think will probably revert back to pre-TCJA amounts. So the credit would kind of be reduced again. There's a phase out of the credit is would also be kind of reduced down as well. This is one that I think potentially has an area of tax savings for the extension of the other provisions. So this is definitely something that we're watching as well. And then alternative minimum tax. So it's kind of been a relative non-issue over the last handful of years, you know, based on the expanded exemption amounts and the expanded, you know, phase out thresholds for the TCJA provisions, as well as the, you know, SALT cap has all kind of made AMT relatively non-existent for the last handful of years. But again, I think this is something that we need to kind of see what happens with the SALT cap, what happens in terms of negotiations. AMT could come back and be more of a planning tool. But again, this is something that I think we need to look at and monitor as we go into 2025 and 2026. We just have a couple of, you know, ways to kind of reduce your taxes, things that you can look at in terms of, you know, tax planning opportunities. Most of the stuff is pretty boilerplate, to be honest with you, you know, 401k contributions, long-term capital gains, rates, et cetera. And then, you know, IRA contributions and things like that too. So this is more just informational for your kind of, for your benefit. And then same thing here is just different ways that we can really reduce income and different tax planning opportunities. The other thing, the only one that I want to highlight, I think, on this one is unreimbursed business expenses related to pass-through activities. This is one that I don't know that, you know, people kind of capture all the time, but can certainly help reduce your taxable income. If you do have unreimbursed business expenses that you can kind of include as part of offsets to your business income from partnerships. So again, I think from an individual perspective, you know, we are looking at a couple of different things, right? Of number one, what's going to happen to the marginal rates? Those are scheduled to kind of revert back January 1, 2026. as of right now, we don't expect that to revert back. But we're kind of monitoring that as we go through. Itemized deductions, specifically related to the SALT cap, you know, what happens in terms of extension of those TCJA provisions. And then generally just, you know, I think the direction that we're going with a lot of the kind of incoming administration is probably lowered rates, expanded brackets such that, you know, overall income is probably taxed at a lower event or lower rate. And then, you know, specific kind of targeted itemized deductions, credits, et cetera, to kind of help offset the projected costs for extension of the TCJA provisions. So I think that's what we're looking for, you know, monitoring into 2025 from an individual tax perspective. We've got polling question number one on screen here. Which area of potential tax legislation are you most closely monitoring in 2025? Individual, businesses, states and trust legislation. And so I think we'll give a minute to respond to that. And while you do that, I'm going to hand it over to Julie, who's going to handle the next section.
Thanks, Mark. I think we can show the results in about 30 more seconds. Okay, so 75% are most concerned with individual tax legislation. So thank you, Mark, for giving us a brief overview. Okay, so as Ryan mentioned, my name is Julie Hulam, and I'm going to shift our focus from our individual tax discussion and jump right into business tax discussion. We'll start with the qualified business income deduction, and this is also known as the Section 199 Cap A deduction. It came a part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, and it was enacted to help taxpayers that were not corporate taxpayers, but are flow through entities that were not given the reduced rate as severe as the cut for the C corps from 35 to 21%. So it was trying to give those taxpayers some relief in the form of a deduction. So what we see here is that on your individual return, you are able to claim a qualified business income deduction. We'll get into more of the details further on. But this is not just for flow-through entities. Sole proprietorships can also claim this deduction. One thing I do want to highlight is that the information needs to be provided on your K-1s from the business in order to have the proper documentation to claim the deduction. The deduction itself is the lesser of 20% of QBI or 20% of your taxable income after removing capital gains and losses. There are kind of two separate silos when you are looking at trader businesses and qualifications and phase outs for this deduction. So there is specified service, trader businesses or just and trader businesses, and specified services are going to be your businesses that are considered consulting and professional service like businesses. Well, and more information on the next slide, but these businesses do have a limitation and a phase out of the QBI deduction. And so that's why they are highlighted. If you are not a specified service business, you still can have a phase out of your limits, which is 50% of W-2 wages or 25% of W-2 wages plus 2.5% of unadjusted assets. And so, like I mentioned previously, information is needed for documentation on your K-1s, you know, your W-2 wages and income items would all be listed out on the footnotes of the K-1s. So the code specifically states what a specified service business is under Section 1202, involving the performance of services in the fields of health, accounting, consulting, law, for example. It does specifically state that if the business is run based on the reputation or skill of the owner employee, that is also considered a specified service. What's interesting also is that architects and engineers are actually specifically excluded from specified services, even though they do seem like they would be considered a professional service in the realm of this provision. They are actually identified as not and would be treated as just a straight trade or business. Okay. Some other considerations with the QBI deduction, S-corps and shareholder compensation, it does reduce QBI. We always talk about reasonable compensation for our shareholder employee owners, making sure that we are taking enough W-2 wages that are considered reasonable for the performance of the services to the firm. Or, you know, if you were to hire someone, you're paying them reasonable. You have to consider that for your own, but it does reduce your QBI income. So depending on that, you may want to increase your wages if you're subject to wage limitation. Switching over to partnership focus, guaranteed payments that a partnership might pay their partners, similar to a W-2, but is not, you know, withholdable wage, is not QBI. We've also listed some other provisions in whether it qualifies or not for QBI. And then just the one other thing I'd like to highlight is that any QBI losses carry over to next year. You know, and this is in an aggregate, each business that you might have would aggregate, if you have a QBI gain or QBI loss from different businesses, they would be aggregated in the tax year. And if there are any losses, they would be carried forward. Okay, switching over to depreciation and cost recovery. So we did see 100% bonus depreciation in the past, which was quite a favorable provision for taxpayers. That was phased out, 100% was phased out at the end of 2022. And so starting in 23, we did see a phase out reduction by 20% to 80% last year for 2024. It's further reduced to 60, and it will continue until it is phased out. Depreciation cost recovery applies to both new and used property. What is different, and we'll get to section 179 in a second, depreciation, bonus depreciation can create a taxable loss at the entity. So that is something that makes it even more important to and cost effective for tax planning. But one thing I do want to highlight is that qualified leasehold improvement property is still eligible for 100% bonus depreciation. So this is, if you think about, you know, renovating your office space or you're moving office spaces and you want to do some renovations to make it up to, you know, your standard or how you want the layout to look at, like, you can still immediately expense those costs under bonus depreciation. But there are a couple caveats. You know, we can't be changing load-bearing walls and the structure of the building. We can't add an elevator. I know those would be, you know, extremely expensive anyways, but, you know, this is really looking for, you know, maybe making some wall dividers and making new offices, but the whole structure of the building stays the same. So similar to bonus, 179 deduction is also, you know, a way to cost recover your expenses for new and used property, but there are more limitations on 179. In general, all of your 179 deduction for an entire year is limited to 1.12% of qualified property, up to a total, if maxed out, if your business income is over $3,350,000. The difference is that the deduction is limited to your taxable income. It cannot create a loss. There are some specific limits on passenger automobiles and what you're allowed to take as the total amount of 179 deduction. If you have, these are, you know, maybe 9 plus passenger vehicles. Okay. So as I mentioned before, we did have 100% write-off up through December 31st, 2022. We will continue to see a decrease in depreciation for bonus until it's fully phased out starting in 2027. Okay. Now to excess business loss limitation rules. This rule limits the amount of business losses that can be offset that can offset non-business income for 2024. The thresholds are listed above. They're pretty significant, but nonetheless are still the thresholds that we're looking at. So to calculate this and how it works, we calculate total business income. We look at your losses and determine if the losses exceed your income by more than those thresholds. And so anything in excess of these thresholds would be disallowed. We are able to carry forward those excess losses in the form of a net operating loss, and can use against an income in the future. But again, we would still have those thresholds amount that would potentially could continue to roll in and hit those thresholds and have excess continuing to roll. One thing I do want to highlight is that this limitation is taken into consideration after you've kind of jumped through all the hoops of the other loss limitation rules. So that's where our little arrow is showing. First, we need to look at basis limitations at risk. And then if we meet all of those criteria, then we're looking at the excess business loss limitations to see if we can still take the loss at the individual level. It is set to remain in effect until through 2028. Okay. So we did look at some provisions that I feel are taxpayer friendly and favorable provisions, but Section 174 and the R&D credit was the one that I feel was most punitive and non-taxpayer friendly from the TCJA Act. And what this was eliminating the immediate expensing of research and development cost. And instead of, 100% expense in the year that you incurred the expense, we now have to capitalize and amortize the expenses. And it also made another silo of our domestic research and development and our foreign research and development. So starting in 2022, domestic R&D had to be capitalized, amortized over 60 months. Foreign is even further cost recovery over 15 years or 180 months. What makes it even harder is that it's a half year convention. So that first year where you're incurring 100% of the cost, you actually only get a 10% cost recovery on that amortization. And, I've seen that this has been a pretty significant provision for some of my clients where, as an R&D or a tech company, they are operating at a book loss or, barely a profit, and then they have to capitalize all of these expenses. And so they're actually recognizing taxable income and sometimes pretty significant taxable income when, there isn't any true revenue for the company. Also want to highlight this also includes software development too. So it's not just making widgets or trying to develop the newest and best widget. It does impact our tech companies. We've seen in the last 2 years many legislation that has failed in Congress. It's passed through one through the House, but it sits in the Senate. It kind of has just been stuck, and it's something that we are monitoring. And hopefully will be something that is considered, because I just feel like this is such a place where we can encourage US development and we're really failing. We do have Section 41 that continues to provide a tax credit for research and development, but unfortunately this is not a one-for-one net between capitalizing all of your costs with the credit. Okay, so we've kind of hit through a lot of federal tax discussion points from the business perspective, and now I just want to jump into the state pass-through entity tax discussion. As Mark said previously, the The SALT limit is $10,000, and it has been, and it's been, you know, really punitive for using and being able to itemize your deductions as in the past. And so in order to circumvent this limitation, many of the states have enacted pass-through entity tax legislation. In fact, 37 or 36 states, including New York City, have are in the last, you know, 5 years allowed taxpayers to opt into this. And so what makes this deduction so helpful is, or these provisions so helpful, is that it become the state taxes paid at the business level become a deduction at the entity level. Taxes paid on behalf of the owners become a credit on your individual return. We have had taxes in the past for state purposes that are paid on behalf of owners, but those have always been treated as distributions. And so it is not a way to reduce taxable income at the entity, which is then flown through to the individual business owner. Pass-through entity taxes are optional, and depending on the state annual election, there are a lot of different timelines and deadlines for making those elections, but this is not applicable to C-Corps. So this, as the name states, pass-through entities, so we're looking at our partnerships and our S-Corps. So in 2020, Maryland enacted their pass-through entity tax, which is 8% of Maryland-sourced income. It does apply to both resident and non-resident partners, member shareholders, but they would still need to file a Maryland state return to claim the credit on the individual return. One little tiny nuance of Maryland pass-through entity tax is that there is a checkbox that says I would like to opt in to Maryland PTE when I'm making my first estimated payment for the next year. And so, you know, that is making your irrevocable election. And it, you know, it is literally a checkbox. And so it's important to make sure that, you know, we're diligently looking at those elections come estimated payment time. Okay, so what are we watching for from a business perspective? I'll continue on with the state discussion. So as Mark again mentioned that the $10,000 limit is scheduled to be phased out, but this does bring up some uncertainty with regards to the state pass-through entity tax. Some states have elected to follow the federal provisions, and so they will also expire. Many states have said that they will continue to offer this option as a way for entities to pay on behalf of their owners. I think that we've gotten to a point where almost all states are offering this, and now we're going to kind of go backwards if the $10,000 cap is not phased out and does not continue, because now we're in this limbo land of where of how many states are going to offer it, who is going to offer it, who's not going to offer it, for example. So lots of state legislation developments to be monitoring in this coming year. Similarly, what I was trying to say is that we need to reevaluate the benefits now versus the administrative burden if, you know, this does phase out and lapse, because now we're looking at trying to make sure we understand all the state laws, what's changed, but also there is administrative burden on trying to make sure we're making all the elections timely, hitting the deadlines, making our estimated payments and any revocable elections. And then, of course, if you've made the election to opt in, they are revocable, and so you will have to continue at least for that year. Okay. From a bonus depreciation perspective, we've discussed that the phase out is going to be stepped down in increments of 20% until it's fully phased out. QBI deduction, which is the benefit for our flow through entities, is also scheduled to lapse after 2025. Business loss limitation rules are going to expire, but please note that this is further expiration date than what we're seeing for 2025, 2026 timing. I did include some international tax rates that are expected to increase in 2026. We could talk about GILTI, be FDII for another 2 hours, so we'll just leave that increase in rates. Okay. So unfortunately, the 174 capitalization is not a temporary provision, and it is not scheduled to lapse. So hopefully that in the future we do see some legislation that will either revert back to prior treatment, or on a go-forward basis, we can start expensing that research and development cost. The corporate tax rate was a permanent reduction to 21%, and we are hearing that there are thoughts to reduce the tax rate even further. And then, of course, not too international heavy, but we are monitoring tax tariff proposals and the impacts from the international perspective. Okay, so with that, we have polling question number two. Do you plan to take advantage of the state pass-through entity tax regime or regimes? Yes, it would save me a lot of federal tax. No, I do not have PTE income, or see much benefit, or not sure. I need to look into this further. Okay, so we'll give everybody about 60 seconds. And after the polling, I'll introduce Ryan again. Okay, I'll just read the results. No, I do not have any PTE income or see much benefit.
Oh, that's kind of a surprising answer, but it can be up to 20% deduction, so that's pretty substantial. So hopefully everybody's looking into it with their accountants. All right, so, oops, sorry. We're going to go through a couple more items here, and this is kind of a hodgepodge, and then we're going to go into estates and taxes. So some other important reminders for 2024 is that net operating losses must be carried forward and are subject to an 80% limitation. This means that you can no longer carry back an NOL. So if you create a deduction, you can no longer go back and amend a return and get a refund. You have to wait till the next year. And the 80% limitation comes in so that there is always a tax on income if you have income in that year. So, for an example, if you have $100,000 of income from your C corporation, that is, and you have an NOL greater than $100,000, you are only able to offset $80,000 and still would be taxed on the $20,000 of income that does not get an NOL. For 24, the meals and entertainment deduction, or I'm sorry, the meals deduction is 50% deductible, and entertainment is 100% non-deductible. For, as Julie mentioned, the five-year amortization for 174 applies to internal and or domestic, and 15 years for international expenses. The max child tax credit is $2,000 per child under 17, subject to phase out. So that's again an income phase out depending on your threshold. Same goes for the max dependent care, which is $3,000 for child or $6,000 for two or more children. So in my case, with four children, I would still be limited to the $6,000. The max dependent care flex spending contribution is $5,000, and that really hasn't changed in quite a long time. And the required minimum distribution from your retirement accounts has been switched from 72 to 73 as far as when you need to start taking distributions. Okay, just for some of the COLA adjustments here, retirement plans. Your 401k and 403b limitations are $23,000 plus $7,500 as a catch up for anybody 50 years or over if they want to. The defined benefit contribution is $69,000. Simple plans are $16,000, and IRA contribution limitations are $6,500 with a catch up of $1,000. Social Security benefits slightly increased by 2.5% for 2025, and the Social Security wage limitation will now be up to $176,100. So this is important when Julie was talking about fair wages. You know, the FICA limitation used to be much lower. Now we're seeing salaries of $176,100 for this year that will be still subjected to FICA, plus that extra 0.9%. I'm going to skip over the QBID because Julie talked about that. The foreign earned income exclusion is scheduled to be $126,500 or $253,000 for married couples. And the bigger topic I'm going to be talking about a little bit later, the lifetime estate and gift exclusion for 2024 is $13,610 per person. And the annual gift exclusion is $18,000. So the adjustments here, I just wanted to show you for 2025, we're nearly getting a $14 million exclusion for your lifetime gifting and estate tax. However, those subject to no changes coming through Congress, and I know a lot of people didn't answer on that first polling question that they were interested in it, and we all know how Congress is really great at making things go through smoothly. We're subject to potentially dropping these down to half. So we're looking at potentially $6 or $7 million as an exclusion. It's still a lot of money, but for somebody having a sale of $20 million, a lot more could be subject to estate and trust taxes. So there's an importance to following along this year and seeing if things are going to pass and possibly making gifts before the end of 2025, if we're not going to see, you know, that that is going to be passed. The annual gift tax exclusion is now for 2025, $19,000 per person. So it's gone up an extra $1,000. And just some of the items that we're going to want to pay attention to for estate and trust taxes. Make sure to follow with the Corporate Transparency Act. I know there was a hold with the federal court system. And this is something we technically cannot provide advice here because you need an attorney involved as to whether or not it applies. But there are special provisions for estates and trusts, so we say to please speak to your attorney regarding those matters. So currently look into state tax implications. So Maryland and DC both have estate taxes, and Maryland has an inheritance tax. Those have very different rates from the federal amounts. And the SECURE Act implemented the delayed RMD rules. So as I mentioned, the required minimum distribution is now once you reach 73 instead of 72 years old. And then there's an elimination of the stretch IRA. So most inherited IRAs must be fully paid out within 10 years of death of the original account holder. So that's something important to look into if you've received an IRA from somebody that's passed away. Okay, the here is the rates, and I'm not going to go through them more specifically, but these are the federal taxable estate brackets once you're past your lifetime exemption. So you can see that the tax rate is quite high once you're above $1 million at 40% federally. And I went through that actually way quicker than I thought, so I apologize for that. But the last polling question, what aspect of tax filings do you find most challenging? understanding new tax laws and regulations, accurately documenting deductions and credits, or meeting the filing deadline. And if anybody has any questions that you want to put into the chat, we will try and address them now. We have some time for questions. And then if there are no questions, then you can always follow up with us afterwards as well. We'll have a little bit more time to follow up on specific questions. All right, the results. So that's not surprising. You know, the three of us get paid for a living to do this, and keeping up with the new tax laws and regulations is hard enough for us. So we certainly understand being outside of that and relying on your tax preparer is a big step, but you need to be able to try and understand them. So that's a good answer, that it's really hard to keep up with those. So you want to make sure you have a great tax preparer that can advise you on all these situations. So don't see anything in the chat. And we will still get our CPE credit if we are on 50 minutes of the hour. So I guess we can go ahead and end. But we will switch to the last slide here, just to show you our contact information. Ooh. Also, I wanted to mention the podcasts are available, and these webinars will be available on our website, so you can listen to them again. So here is our information if you want to reach out to us. And I wanted to thank both Julie and Mark for joining me today. And thank you all as well for joining us. And please, again, let us know if you have any follow-up questions. So again, not seeing anything in the chat. So everybody have a great day, and stay warm.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the GRF On The Go podcast. Visit our website at grfcpa.com for more information about the services we provide, the industries we serve, or to request a quote.